Journey to Topaz by Yoshiko Yoshida. Chapter 11. A Home in the Desert. They rode all night and through the next day, and still another night before they reached Utah. Yuki had never spent two more miserable nights in all her life. The train was hot and stuffy, the water ran out, and the seats grew harder every minute. Yuki squirmed and wriggled and yawned and stretched, and finally poked Mother to see if she was still up too. The only span of relief had come in the second morning, when the train pulled to a stop in the middle of a barren Nevada desert, and everyone was permitted to get off to stretch and breathe some fresh air for a few minutes. Even in the midst of the desert, however, they were guarded by a row of armed soldiers, as though they were prisoners who might try to escape. When at last they arrived at Delta, Utah, Yuki was so stiff she could scarcely walk to the buses that were lined up waiting to take them to the last leg of their journey to Topaz. Everyone was hot and tired and sleepless, and even Emmy's grandmother seemed to have lost her energy. Yuki noticed how pale Emmy looked and how quiet she had grown during the journey. She hadn't even wanted to play cards with her and Yuki, and Yuki had finally wheedled Ken into a game of hearts. When they were seated in the buses and saw the surrounding countryside, however, there was a general lifting of spirits. "Topaz is such a beautiful golden name," Mother said hopefully. "It surely can't be too bad a place. And look," she added cheerfully, "everything looks so fresh and green." There were houses with flowering gardens and leafy shade trees and fields full of growing things. Yuki began to feel better. If Topaz was going to be like this, it might be a wonderful place. "Didn't I tell you Utah might be nice?" she asked Ken. But he was saving his opinion for later. "We're not in Topaz yet," he observed. The buses moved quickly through the small town, passed a few farms, and then entered the severe desert. Gradually the trees and the grass and the flowers began to disappear. Soon there was no vegetation at all, and they were surrounded by a vast gray-white desert where nothing grew except dry clumps of greasewood. The eager, hopeful voices on the bus died down and soon stopped altogether. Mother said nothing more, and Yuki herself grew silent. At the western rim of the desert, they could see a tall range of mountains, but long before they reached their sheltering shadows, the buses made a sharp left turn, and there, in the midst of the desert, they came upon rows and rows of squat, tar-papered barracks, sitting in a pool of white dust that had once been, page 96, the bottom of a lake. They had arrived at Topaz, the Central Utah War Relocation Center, which would be their new home. Ken turned to look at Yuki. Well, here we are, he said dryly. This is beautiful Topaz. The minute Yuki stepped off the bus, she felt the white, powdery dust of the desert engulf her like a smothering blanket. The Boy Scout drum and bugle corps had come out to welcome the incoming buses, but now they looked like flour-dusted cookies that had escaped from a bakery. Yuki coughed while one of the team of doctors inspected her throat, and then she ran quickly to talk to Emmy, while Ken finished registering the family. "We've been assigned to Block 7, Barrack 2, Apartment C," she informed her. "Try to get the room next door." Emmy nodded. "Okay, I'll tell Grandma," she said, for they both knew that if anybody could manage such an arrangement, Grandma could. A boy about Ken's age offered to take them out to their new quarters. He had come in one of the earlier contingents and already knew his way around the big, sprawling barrack city. "It's a mile square," he explained as they started toward Block 7, and like a guide on a tour, he told them all he knew about Topaz. "There are 42 blocks, and each block has 12 barracks, with a mess hall and a latrine washroom in the center," he pointed out. "When the barracks are all finished and occupied, we'll be the fifth largest city in Utah." "Imagine," Mother said. It sounded impressive, but Yuki thought she had never seen a more dreary place in all her life. Page 97. There wasn't a single tree or a blade of grass to break the monotony of the sun-bleached desert. It was like the carcass of a chicken, stripped clean of any meat and left all dry and brittle bone. The newly constructed road was still soft with churned-up dust, and they sank into it with each step as though they were plowing through a snowbank. "Whoever built this camp wasn't very bright," Ken observed as he struggled along. "Why?" Yuki asked, although she could think of several reasons herself. For one thing, she certainly wouldn't have covered all the barracks with black tar paper. It made the camp looked so bleak and uninviting. She would have painted the barracks all different colors. Maybe one block would be pink and lavender, with rose-colored chimneys and roofs, and another block would be blue and green with some sunny yellow roofs. "Why?" she asked Ken again. "Well, if they'd left some of the greenwood growing, the roots would have held down some of the dust," he explained. "As it is, they've churned up this whole campsite like one big sack of loose flour." "You're right," their guard agreed. "You should see one of our dust storms. You'll wish you'd never heard of topaz when you've been in one of those." Yuki shuddered. It sounded horrible. It was bad enough, even without the wind, for the dust just hung in the air, sifting into her eyes and into her nose and mouth with each breath. Mother was holding a handkerchief over her nose and mouth, so Yuki could see only her eyes, her lashes fringed with dust. The sun blazed down on them, making Yuki feel dry and parched. Page 98. Deep down inside. Her heart felt shriveled, and her lungs seemed to be drying up. Her head felt light, as though it were floating on somebody else's body, and when the guide said something about the altitude, his voice sounded far away. "Well, here we are," he said at last. "Your room is in the center of the barrack. The center rooms are for smaller families. The end rooms for couples, and the ones in between are for big families." Yuki was glad to see that their new room was bigger than the horse stall, measuring about 18 by 20, but it was just as bleak. There was nothing in the room except three army cots. The inner sheet rock walls hadn't yet been installed, so dust had filtered in the room from every crack in the siding and around the windows. It covered the floor, gathered in drifts in the corners, and hung in the air so that Yuki could taste it in her mouth. Their guide pointed to the small, black-bellied stoves that stood outside their door, warning, "Don't touch those stoves until the crews come to install them, and don't put up any shelves yet, because you'll have to take them down when they put in the sheet rock walls and ceilings, okay?" Ken nodded. "Okay, thanks." "Well, good luck," the young boy said, and he left quickly as though he didn't want to be around when they began to feel discouraged. Mother sat down carefully on the dust-covered springs of one of the cots and looked around. "Well, I suppose we should look for a broom," she said wearily, but she didn't seem to have the heart to start cleaning. Page 99. Yuki flopped down on another of the cots and glanced through the instruction sheets that were given to them when they registered. "Listen," she said, reading aloud. "You are now in Topaz, Utah. Here we say dining hall, not mess hall. Safety council, not internal police. Residents, not evacuees. And last but not least, mental climate, not morale." Ken groaned. "Never mind," he objected. "I don't want to hear any more of that junk." But Yuki went on reading to Mother that there would eventually be four bathtubs installed in each block. "Emmy's grandmother will be glad," she said with a grin. "And listen, it says there'll be individual basins, too. No more tin troughs." Yuki felt cheered enough to do some investigating. "I'll go see if it's as good as they say," she said, hurrying off to make an inspection. She discovered, however, that the facilities were still far from complete. There were no seats on the toilets, no hot water in the laundry, and no lights anywhere. And while Yuki was splashing cold water on her face, the water became a weak dribble, and then stopped completely. Their water supply was coming from nearby artesian wells, and already it was strained from overuse. Yuki went back to her barracks and reported her findings. "You know something, Mama?" she said bleakly. "My mental climate is lousy." "Well, Topaz isn't exactly a summer resort, Yuki," Ken answered, and he went off to look for some mattresses and a broom. It took several days for them to get used to the heat and altitude of Topaz. The doctors gave out salt tablets, but they only, page 100, made Yuki feel worse, and she stopped eating altogether when the refrigerators broke and the entire block came down with food poisoning. It was so cold in the mornings that Yuki wore her heaviest slacks and sweater, but by afternoon, even her summer shorts felt hot. It was as though summer and winter had gotten mixed up and arrived together here in the desert to confuse and confound them. The time that Yuki liked best was just after sunset, when the air was still and the sky became a roaring blaze of color. A desert sky, uncluttered by city smoke, was the most beautiful sight Yuki had ever seen. She loved the night sky, too, when the stars danced across the vast blackness and seemed almost to rush toward her in their dazzling brilliance. The stars seemed much closer than in Berkeley, and the moon was an enormous yellow-orange ball that looked like a nighttime sun. Yuki felt sure there must be some poetry in the desert sky, but the right words didn't seem to come, even to Mother. Emmy and her grandparents lived in the same block, two barracks away. Often, after supper, Yuki and Mother would meet Emmy and her grandmother outside the mess hall, and all together they would walk along the northern edge of the camp, just beyond their block. As they walked, they could see the camp hospital with its black smokestack and the watchtowers that rose high above the cluster of barracks. Just beyond the barbed wire fence, they could see the barracks of the military police, and sometimes they would hear them singing in the still desert air. "I suppose they are lonely, too," Mother would say softly. "Surely they cannot be happy here either, so far from home." On this particular warm evening, they walked with their eyes, page 101, on the distant mountains, watching them gradually disappear into the growing darkness. Emmy and Yuki walked along ahead of Mother and Mrs. Kurihara, hearing only the soft murmur of their voices behind them. Emmy scuffled her toes in the dust, keeping her head down and watching the ground. "Why do you keep looking at your feet?" Yuki asked. "The sky is a lot prettier." "I know," Emmy answered, "but Grandpa found two arrowheads in the ground near our barracks, and he says this whole area must be full of interesting things. The man next door found a fossilized trilobite, and I'm looking for one for Grandpa." Now Yuki found herself watching the ground as well. It would be fun to find an old arrowhead, chiseled from stone hundreds of years ago by some Indian warrior. It made her blood tingle to think of Indians hunting and fishing around what once was a great salt lake. And she wondered what they would think now, to find their lake all dried up, with thousands of Japanese living upon it. Yuki was so caught up in searching the ground now that she didn't notice how much Emmy was coughing, or how pale she looked in spite of all the sun. As suddenly as the wind that sprang from the desert to sweep through Topaz, Emmy fell to the ground like a small sack, crumpling soundlessly in a tiny heap. "Emmy!" Yuki shouted. Her grandmother and mother rushed to her side. "Emmy-chan! What has happened, Emmy-chan?" Yuki looked up and saw the camp hospital, 100 yards away. "I'll go find a doctor," she said, and ran on rubbery legs, panting and gasping and stumbling in the soft dust. Page 102. Before she had gotten halfway, she saw two white men in white coats coming toward her. They were doctors from the hospital, coming off duty and returning to their barracks. "Help!" Yuki shouted, scarcely knowing how to begin telling them what happened. She pointed to Emmy and the two women hovering over her, and the doctors, seeing Yuki's frightened face, knew what to do. They ran to Emmy and bent over her. By the time Yuki caught up with them, they were feeling her pulse and lifting her eyelids and telling Mrs. Kurihara that they'd carry her to the hospital. "Don't worry," one of the doctors reassured them. "It's probably just heat prostration." But Yuki felt a sudden chill come over her, and the mild evening desert breeze seemed now to hold the cold breath of night.